Hey there, welcome to episode 342 of the Fantastic Forecast. I'm Dave Elliott, and this podcast is a cry for help. On today's episode, Fantastic Four 342 from July 1990, Burnout by Danny Fingeroth and Rex Valve. Danny Finger what and Rex who? Uh-oh. This is a dreaded fill-in issue. Remember those kids? Back in the day, if a writer or artist, couldn't get an issue out in time, instead of delaying the issue, they'd run a fill-in issue. Sometimes a reprint, but in 1990, more likely, it was an original story, which was always worse than a reprint. I may be wrong about this, but in the 81 years or so that comic books have existed, I don't think there has ever been a good fill-in issue. Or maybe, just maybe, this issue will be the exception. You're right. Now, this is the worst kind of fill-in issue. Walt Simonson did the artwork for the cover, and he did the art on the first page of the issue to set up the flashback story. So when I plunked down my $1 at the comic book store in 1990 and rushed home to read the latest Simonson FF masterpiece, I did not know what I was in for. But I get to the second page. Turns out, it's by Danny Finger What and Rex Who. Ugh. I should have known there would be trouble, because the cover promises a team-up between the Human Torch and Rusty from X-Factor. Oh yeah, the team-up that everyone was demanding. But then again, Simonson had just been the artist on X-Factor, so it wasn't really suspicious that he would bring in one of those characters into the pages of the FF. But then, on closer examination, the cover artwork is not by Walter Simonson. It's by Tom Morgan, doing a terrible Simonson impersonation and signing his name with a big O so that it looks like Walt's signature. I assume he also did the first page of art, too. Marvel really went out of their way to make sure they screwed my teenaged self out of a hard-earned dollar. So as I said, the story begins in the present with a page that takes place right after the end of last issue. Sharon, Ben, and Johnny are alone, and Sharon tells Johnny he looks exhausted. It must have been a terrible ordeal for him. He says he feels fine. It's no worse than having to look at Ben's ugly face every morning. What a charmer. Sharon says it must have been tough to be totally under the control of Nebula. It reminds her of the time Johnny lost control over his flame, and Ben tells her not to bring it up, saying Johnny almost quit after that. Now, wait a minute. Johnny lost control over his flame during the Inferno storyline. That is a completely different storyline from this. Johnny doesn't lose control over his flame in this story, but here we go. Here's the flashback. So the story begins with Johnny. He's in Chuck's garage, an auto repair place, doing repair work on his own car. Must be one of those do-it-yourself car repair places. His wife is there hanging out, too. Boy, that must be a real delight for her. He's doing a little welding on his car when he hears a report on the radio about a young man named Theodore Bannion, who set himself on fire and died. And he left a note saying that he could never be as great as Johnny Storm, so he decided to end his life as a real Human Torch. Okay, so now they're ripping off John Byrne's story Hero from issue 285. Johnny, as you can imagine, is not a happy camper to hear this story. He flames on, he yells out, "No!" In the process, he blows up his Jaguar. He sets fire to the entire garage. You know, it would be funny if in his rage about the kid burning up, Johnny killed a bunch of mechanics and his Skrull wife. Everyone runs for their lives, and Lijah asks, "Johnny, what happened?" She's blind, not deaf. She didn't hear the radio? Before he burns down the entire neighborhood, Johnny soaks up all the flames, saving the neighborhood, but not Chuck's garage. He flies down and apologizes to Chuck, and says he feels awful and adds that the FF will pay him for his loss. Chuck is dazed and says, "Ugh, just give me a second to recover. My whole life, all gone up in smoke." I wonder if Johnny will also pay the other mechanics who just lost their jobs because he destroyed their workplace. So Johnny grabs Lijah the Skrull and he's going to fly her home, but he changes his mind and says he'd rather walk. Lijah says, "What's wrong? I trust you not to burn me." So later, when they're walking home, Elijah is telling Johnny not to blame himself for what that kid did. People do weird things sometimes. Johnny says it's not the first time that's happened, and he recalls the boy Tommy Hansen who burned himself up in FF-285. She suggests that maybe the media is blowing things out of proportion, and he should go to Floral Ridge High School over in New Jersey and check it out for himself. He says that sounds like a good idea, and instead of flying, he decides to drive his pickup truck. Yes, his pickup truck. Johnny calls it his new pickup truck. The new pickup truck he will never drive again because Johnny is not a pickup truck kind of guy. I guess Rex Valve just wanted to draw a pickup truck, so now Johnny's in a pickup truck for the first and last time. 35 minutes later, he arrives at a small town in New Jersey and heads to the high school, where he receives a mixed reception from some of the students. Some of the kids are happy to see him, and others, not so much. And then one white-haired old lady dressed up in a 1980s Madonna-style outfit runs over and starts pounding on Johnny's chest. "My brother's dead because of you. Dead. He never hurt anybody in his life. And now he's dead. I hate you. I hate you." Wait a minute. This old lady, who's dressed up like a teenage girl, is supposed to be Theodore Banion's sister. I think she's supposed to be a teenage girl, but honestly, if you look at the art, she looks like an old lady. It's crazy. Joey, a friend of Theodore, tells her not to be ragging on Teddy's hero, and she says, "Go ahead, worship your hero. I gotta get out of here." And she runs off crying, never to be seen again. So Joey takes Johnny over to meet the rest of Teddy's friends, and they're all dressed up like punk rockers and metalheads. One girl with a pink mohawk sees Johnny, and she's like, "Hey, hot stuff." And she goes over and starts trying to make out with him. He says he just wants to talk, and she says, "Why waste time talking, cutie? Mmm." And Johnny's like, hey, stop. The gang tells Johnny they'll take him to the Baxter Building. "The Baxter Building?" asks a confused Johnny Storm. So they take him to their hangout, the back of an old truck, at an auto wrecking yard, which they lovingly call the Baxter Building. Inside, they've got some chairs and a sofa, and the walls have Human Torch posters and Motley Crue posters. So the gang explains to Johnny that they all see life for the absurd joke that it is. The world thinks they're freaks because of their bad attitudes. There is no point to life, and they all plan to end their lives by 1991, killing themselves by burning themselves to death, just like Teddy did. He was just the first one. Oh, yikes. These kids are freaks. Johnny says, I can't believe what I'm hearing. You guys are so wrong. Sure, these are weird, scary times. Especially, I assume, if you're living in New Jersey. But it's always been rough. Always. So you gotta take the good with the bad, and you go on. You gotta. But Teddy's way, that's no answer, Johnny says. One guy replies, "Sure it is. We're never gonna be like you. Famous. Living the high life. We got one shot at glory in our lives. To go out in a big flame like a supernova. Today, these are the kind of idiot kids that post videos of themselves doing stupid stuff on YouTube in the hopes that it'll go viral and they'll end up talking to Daniel Tosh. But in the late 1980s, there was no YouTube. If you wanted attention, you had to set yourself on fire." So Johnny is flabbergasted. He's begging the kids not to do it, not to kill themselves by setting themselves on fire. One girl says that if they don't die young, they'll just end up like their parents, slaves at some rotten job. Someone needs to tell these little kids that life seems shitty when you're a teenager, but things get better. Actually, that's not true. Things don't get better, but someone should lie to them and tell them it does. Johnny says that he'll do whatever he can to stop the kids, and he says that from this moment on, he'll never use his flames again, so they have nothing to imitate. Of course, he's forgetting that at this point in time, the original Human Torch is a member of the West Coast Avengers, so they can imitate him. So Johnny, who's crying, leaves and gets back in his truck, and is hoping that maybe he got through to the kids. The gang looks at him, and one of them says, "Woo, some act. Did you catch the fake tears?" These are cynical little pricks, aren't they? So later, Over at the Banyan family household, Teddy's dad is chatting on the phone, and he's worried that he's drinking too much, but then he realizes, fuck, how can you drink too much when your kid sets himself on fire? And of course, he blames the Human Torch, and he says he's going to make him pay. And how will he do that, you might wonder? In court? Filing a lawsuit? Nah, that's the way things are handled here in 2014. But back in the late 1980s, if you had a problem and you wanted revenge, you open up the secret panel in your wall and take out your killer robot suits. And that's exactly what Mr. Banyan does. Back at FF headquarters, Johnny's standing on the roof and looking down at the street and thinking that he could easily just jump off, not flame on, and his life would be over. But he ain't gonna do that. He's not crazy. He doesn't understand why anyone would kill themselves. Next, he decides to head downstairs and tell the others that he's quitting being the Human Torch. He finds the rest of the team in the middle of a practice session. You have the She Thing, the He Thing, still with the big pointy rocks, and Crystal. He tells everyone that he's too dangerous a role model to certain people. You know, maybe they could find a better role model. Hey, there's a new band around this time called Nirvana. There's a lead singer that he could be their role model. Ben tells Johnny that the kids are intent on killing themselves, and if Johnny quits being the Human Torch, they'll just latch on to some other nutty idea. But Johnny says that if giving up being the Human Torch can save even one life, it'll be worth it. So later, Johnny's walking in Central Park, lost in thought, when this young redheaded guy runs over and tells Johnny he's an inspiration to him. And this is not what Johnny wants to hear right now. He barks at the guy, "Get out of my face, kid! I've had it with being on the top of every psycho's love list. Beat it!" The redheaded guy's like, I'm sorry to have bothered you. And he starts to leave, but Johnny realizes what a dick he had just been, and he calls the guy back over and apologizes, saying that he has a lot on his mind. He tells him about the kid who killed himself, impersonating the Human Torch, and the redhead says, "Torch, you're looking at this all wrong. Let me tell you my story." But before he can tell his story, Mr. Banyan shows up in his killer robot armor, along with his two brothers, also in killer robot armor, and they call themselves the Seekers. They toss some fire retardant grenades toward Johnny. The redheaded guy, I just figured out it's Rusty from X-Factor, he tells the Seekers to leave him alone. He won't go quietly. He's obviously under the impression they're trying to attack him. But the Seekers say they have no idea who Rusty is. They're there for the Torch, to avenge the death of Ted Banyan. And one of the Seekers zaps Rusty and Johnny with a blast from his sound cannon. Johnny tells the Seekers he didn't kill Teddy, and adds, "Whoever sent you can't actually think that killing me will solve anything." Mr. Banyan replies, "Nobody sent us, Torch. This is purely self-motivated." And then a Seeker wraps his big chain around Johnny and pins him to a tree. They think they've attacked so fast that Johnny hasn't had a chance to use his powers, but Johnny corrects him and says he tells him that he's decided not to use his powers anymore. Mr. Banyan says that's not enough. The punishment for what he did to his son is death. And Banyan wraps his armored hand around Johnny's throat and starts to choke him. The hand comes off the suit, but keeps choking Johnny. Banyan says he's got a spare hand, which he puts on. Now Rusty comes over. He uses his flame powers to burn the glove and the chain and free Johnny. The Seekers are confused. They thought Johnny just said that he wasn't going to use his powers anymore. They don't realize that Rusty is a big flamer too. Rusty has melted the bottom of the Seekers' boots, and all three of them are stuck to the ground and surrounded by a wall of fire. And all they can do is watch while Johnny and Rusty run away. The two flamers, you know, maybe that's not the best way to describe Johnny and Rusty. They get out of the park and Rusty hails a cab. He sticks Johnny in the cab, just as Johnny passes out, and Rusty gets in. He scares the cabbie off with some flames, and he takes the wheel and the cab speeds off. A little later, the three Seekers have broken free, and they fly out of the park, but Rusty and Johnny are gone. One of the Seekers says that once his power shackle touches a victim, he can trace its residual energy for days. But Mr. Banyan says they plan to get to Johnny within the hour. 15 minutes later, the cab reaches Queens, and Johnny wakes up. Rusty tells him that he has flame powers too. He's a mutant who's currently training with X-Factor. He mistakenly thought the Seekers were mutant hunters. He tells Johnny a story about how he almost killed a girl before he knew how to control his powers, and X Factor helped him realize the good he could do with his powers. Johnny says he understands, but he's still sick with guilt, and kinda wishes the Seekers had killed him. Just then, the Seekers show up, and they're happy to oblige. They shoot these fire-retardant grenades into the cab, and the cab crashes into a light post. Johnny and Rusty get out, and they run into a furniture warehouse. The Seekers fly in after them, shooting stuff and smashing up the place. That fire-retardant gunk is in Rusty's eyes, and he can't see, so Johnny's leading him around. They reach a fuse box, and Johnny has Rusty burn it out. Supposedly, this cuts off the lights in the warehouse, but by the way it's drawn, it's hard to tell. The Seekers get close to Rusty and Johnny tells him to shoot his flames, full strength forward, down the hall, trapping the Seekers in a powerful blast of flames. They're burning up, their insulation is starting to fail, and Johnny calls out for them to take off their suits of armor, and the flames will stop. So all three men, not being too keen on being burned to death, comply. Seconds later, a SWAT team arrives to arrest the Seekers. Mr. Banyan tells Johnny, "We'll meet again, only next time there won't be any warning. Next time you'll just be dead." That's probably the last thing he should be saying in front of the cops who are arresting him. I just googled Thomas Banyan to see if he ever did come back to try to kill Johnny, and surprisingly, he does show up a few more times in Amazing Spider-Man, a West Coast Avengers annual, and in the pages of Darkhawk. So it sounds like he never does come back for Johnny. Also, this wasn't his first appearance. He first showed up in Iron Man 214, which I've read, but I have no memory of him at all. So Johnny and Rusty head back to FF headquarters. Rusty's eyes are cleared up and he can see again. Johnny finally decides to flame on again. He's decided that the good of being the Human Torch outweighs the bad. So later, after Johnny has gotten rid of his new friend, he's relaxing, reading a book, Aristotle for crying out loud. He hears a tapping on his window. He rushes over to see that it's Spider-Man, in a completely unnecessary cameo appearance. He read about that kid in New Jersey who killed himself, and he dropped by to see how Johnny's doing. Spidey mentions there's been a few times where he thought about hanging up his webs, and then he goes over and he raids the refrigerator. I'm not sure if Spidey really cares about Johnny, or if he just dropped by for free food. Finally, a few days later, Johnny is giving a speech to the student body at Floral Ridge High School. He tells the kids that as long as they live, they can always hope that their lives will get better, but if they kill themselves, that hope is gone. He says, "I'm just begging you guys, ride out the tough times. They almost always get better." As they listen, Teddy's friends start thinking that maybe he's right. Maybe they won't kill themselves after all. Johnny finishes up by telling them that there are hotlines and crisis centers and support groups they could contact if they ever need any help. He wonders if he's reaching anybody, but at least he's trying, which is all he can do. And that's it. That's the end of the issue. Do the kids go through with killing themselves by 1991? Nobody knows, and nobody cares. It's just a fill-in issue. The thing I don't understand is, all those teenage kids told Johnny they planned to commit suicide before 1991, and Johnny, he doesn't tell anyone. You would think it might be a good idea for Johnny to find the kids' parents and tell them, let them know. But, nope, he doesn't do that. He just gives a speech at the high school filled with cliches and empty platitudes, and he crosses his fingers. Way to go, Johnny. So that's it for now. You can download other episodes at iTunes or find them all at www.podcastff.podbean.com. You can join the Facebook page at www.facebook.com/podcastff. And if you have any questions about the Fantastic Four, about this podcast, or if you need any relationship advice, you can email me at podcastff@gmail.com. So long, kids. This podcast is over.